Hey, real quick, I just wanted to let you know that Gabba Gabba Huh is now a record store. Well, not really a store, but a booth at an antique store located in Eastridge Mall in Gastonia, North Carolina. Vintage Village is three stores down from Dillard's on the left. And my booth is on the left side of Vintage Village. It's the one with all the records. You can't miss it. I've got over 1,000 records, toys, t-shirts, DVDs, VHS, all kinds of stuff there. So come check it out. Gabba Gabba Huh Records and Vintage Goods, located in Vintage Village at Eastridge Mall, Gastonia, North Carolina. You are now listening to the Gabba Gabba Huh Talks podcast, where we bring you conversations with people connected to the Carolinas underground music scene. Your host, Mike Phillips of Van Huskins. Hey.
Hey, there he is.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Just making sure I got my levels good here. So how have you been doing?
Pretty good. I moved to a new house about a month ago, so it's just been constant projects.
Oh, yeah.
There's probably 2 years worth of projects, but it's also fun just to kind of like remake a place into your own.
Oh, yeah.
So spend a lot of time in the yard this weekend because finally last week it's like someone's flipped a switch and the Mississippi humidity went away. So it's been nice to actually kind of be out in the yard, cleaning it up a little bit and not sweating as immediately when I walk out the door.
Oh, yeah, I understand that. Yeah, North Carolina is a lot the same, you know, probably not as bad as it is down there, but it's been kind of, this past week's been a nice little break.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is pretty similar. I think there's like maybe 2-3 weeks in the summer that gets just a little bit worse down here. Like in North Carolina, I always felt like when it was like 90 degrees, I could still kind of go outside.
Yeah.
And like here, if it's like in the middle of summer, even 85 feels miserable because of the humidity.
Yeah,
so it's like just a little more humid, and that makes all the difference in the world. But yeah, I think you're right. By like October, it's pretty much the same.
Yeah.
It is like North Carolina also in the sense that like it's really unpredictable. So you'll get, even in the middle of summer, sometimes like a week where it's nice and cool and teases you, and then suddenly like it's like hot as hell again and you don't want to go outside for 4 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
So.
All right. And we can kind of get started pretty much any time here.
Okay.
I'm talking to John Rash, and currently you're involved in a project called the Southern Punk Archive. I think did I get that right?
You got it.
Okay. And we'll talk about that in a little while. You've also played, I know you were in Crimson Spectre. What other bands have you played in?
I was in a band called the Heebie Jeebies, which was my first band in high school. And I played one show just as a one-off with the Super Spies.
Okay.
So with Matt Wilburn. So That was a fun one as well. That one and only performance, which was completely unpracticed, unrehearsed, was captured in the Boone Punk documentary.
Yeah.
So I feel like I was in that band more than I was whenever I watched that documentary, which was a really cool and amazing documentary that I know you guys have talked about a lot in the past on the show.
Oh, yeah.
But it always surprises me to see myself in there. So, oh yeah, I was in that band for just a minute.
I love that documentary because it's just really cool snapshot of that time. And there wouldn't be any other real document of it if that didn't exist. I mean, there would be cassette tapes, demo tapes, and things like that, but a few pictures. But just, you know, that's cool that exists.
For sure. And I think a lot of the even videos that I've come across that have come into the archive, because I've been digging up stuff, which I guess we'll talk about a little bit later, from Boone of that era, is mostly stuff that I think Matt was shooting for that documentary. So,
and we were lucky. I've been doing some digitizing over here lately, and we were kind of lucky in that our friend Brad had a video camera, and we made him bring it out everywhere, and we recorded as many shows as we could. I've lost a few along the way. You know, I still got a ton of stuff that we recorded back then.
Yeah, you know, I got into photography along the way, and I kind of regret, it seems like I only took my camera to like some of the bigger shows and photographed a lot of like, not so many of my friends' bands and local bands, but more of the bigger bands. I think part of it's because I was doing it for the zine that I was publishing at the time, but I look back at those photos and just want to kick myself for not documenting the people around me that I cared the most about at that time.
I think about that too when I go back and look at my pictures. You know, I took my camera out to a handful of shows, and it's, you know, I took a bunch of pictures whenever I did, but it was never, well, every now and then it was friends' bands, but I think it was more like, you know, those shows you just wanted to go and you wanted to have a good time. You didn't want to have to worry about taking pictures. Then the other shows, it's like, well, I want to document this and say I was here or something like that. But it's, you know, it definitely had to do with just having a good time.
For sure. And I think now I'm actually like lean hard the other direction for two reasons. One is I do feel more aware of the need to document things that are happening around me, and also know that I might be the one person going to the show that has the ability to do that sort of thing. So it's kind of a responsibility I've bestowed upon myself. But also, being an older guy going to shows a lot of times alone, because I still don't know a lot of people here in Mississippi, mm-hmm. it kind of puts me in a comfortable place and allows me to sort of at least be on a date with my camera when I go to shows these days. Oh, yeah. And I feel like I probably take my camera to every show I go to now, just for that reason. It kind of gives me a purpose, because I don't really have anyone to hang out with yeah. until the bands play.
Well, that's awesome. We'll kind of get started with my usual question, which you should know is basically, what was it about music when you were a kid that sort of grabbed you, that made you start paying attention to music?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, my parents didn't really get into music as deep as what I feel like a lot of people's parents do. I can't remember them ever introducing me to music and making me feel like, oh, this is really cool, you should listen to this. Like, they had a couple records sitting around. I feel like my dad had like one Eagles record and like one Santana record, yeah. and that was kind of it. And like, so like, it definitely didn't come from them, but I guess at some point they did get me sort of a tape player. And I do remember, I mean, just getting, you know, like movie soundtracks and things that like kids were into in the 80s, like nothing that was really great. But yeah. by the time I came to middle school, there were some newer kids in middle school that seemed a lot cooler than the kids that I knew from my elementary school that I started hanging out with. And come to find out, like, a lot of them were into skateboarding or snowboarding and listened to punk. And this one guy made a, thinking back, I don't even know if he made this mixtape for me. Because when he gave it to me, it was completely unlabeled. Mm-hmm. wasn't even in like a plastic case. So it was just like a tape that I think he may have been carrying around listening to. It was like, all right, dude, you want to listen to this stuff? Like, just take, this is the mix I've been listening to that I'm tired of. He didn't say it that way, yeah. but thinking back on it, I kind of think that's what the deal was. Because like, I didn't know who any of the bands were, had no way of finding out until just sort of over time, asking people and just sort of exposure. But that tape had Minor Threat and Fugazi, Agent Orange, Circle Jerks, Descendants. Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of like the canon, you yeah. know, that you would think of. And I mean, I listened to it and I was like, these people sound really fucking pissed off. And like, some of these songs, like, I don't know if I really like them, but they make me feel excited. And like, I remember just listening to that tape over and over again, just trying to figure it out. It was kind of like being put in one of those escape rooms to a certain degree. Like, it was just like I wanted to figure out what it was and find the keys so that I could like go deeper into that world. And in a lot of ways, not knowing even the names of the bands, much less the names of the songs, made it even more intriguing. Oh, yeah. So, you know, as I found out who each band was, I would go buy their tape mm-hmm. and just sort of go deeper into that world. And I just fell in love with it through that process.
So what, that time, like, where were you going to buy your music at? Was it just like the mall at Camelot Music, or?
It was the Record Bar at the Boone Mall. Yeah. So like, luckily by that time, you know, a lot of those bands, they would have had their tapes. Yeah, yeah. You know, I guess like anybody that gets into punk initially, like you sort of get into the punk that's most accessible. And then it was probably a couple years later that I started to find out about stuff that was like not available at the Record Bar. Yeah. And I had to send cash in an envelope in the mail and hope that it got there. And then I would get what did it take? Probably a month turnaround before you would get something back by that point. So I would just keep my eye on my mailbox constantly, just hoping that, you know, my money wasn't stolen and that something would appear. Yeah. And I do remember at one point, and this was probably the first thing I ordered in the mail like that, I ordered a flip side video comp because it had the Descendants on it. And I really loved the Descendants from that initial tape that that guy gave me. It came back and it was a VHS that with like copy and paste, sort of like glue sticked on cover around the edge of like a Maxwell VHS tape. And I watched it. It was barely visible and the audio quality was even worse. I just didn't understand at the time that like that was punk rock and that it was just amazing that that video of the Descendants playing and like whatever it was like 1982 or whatever existed at all. And I remember calling them and telling them how terrible their product was and that I wanted to return it. And the lady just laughed at me and she was like, "You don't listen to a lot of punk rock, do you?" And I was like, "Well, I ordered the video for the Descendants and it took me forever to figure out even which band it was on the tape because I can't see any of it." And she was like, "Fine, just send it back and we'll send you something else." I think I got a t-shirt or something instead. But anyway, it's all a learning process, you know, and like now I wish I had that Flipside video comp because they're probably pretty hard to find. Right. Although I think that video, I did find it on YouTube at some point and was like, "Oh, cool. That's like the very first kind of DIY video recording I ever saw," even though I thought it was garbage and sent it back when I was like 13 years old or whatever.
And that's the beauty of like the internet these days. I mean, there's a lot of bad things about the internet and a lot of downsides to the internet. But one of the good things is it's a great archival tool right now because there are all kinds of stuff like that that you forgot about. If you go look for it on YouTube, a lot of times you can find it. Somebody's put it up there.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to try to do a little bit more of that with you know, archiving some stuff that's not available there. Eventually. So that's part of what I want to do with this project as well.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I mean, that's one of the reasons I thought, there's a couple of reasons I started sort of diving heavy into video with the Southern Punk Archive is because there is a lot of stuff that I happen to have access to, a lot of North Carolina bands, just because those are folks that I knew and kind of had gathered and had just sitting in shoeboxes in my closet and realized that, like, none of the stuff was online, none of it's on YouTube. But then also thinking about, you know, what happened to bands that had their music on MySpace and other sites over time that went sort of south and disappeared is it's great to have stuff on YouTube, but I also have the advantage working at the university that I can put these things into a repository that's held by an institution and not by a corporation and not by an individual so that with a great deal of trust, that stuff will be there when I'm no longer here, you know, and it won't be thrown in the bin by a family member or a corporation that says you haven't logged into your account in 3 years, you know. So in a lot of ways, that preservation has little to do about people seeing it now and a lot about people having access to it 50 or 100 years from now.
Okay, and I love that because we talk about that all the time on this podcast, that documentation is important just because, you know, we're not all going to be here forever. So have these stories last, the stories and the songs and everything kind of last beyond us.
For sure. And I've heard too many heartbreaking stories of people who either put out records with their own bands or for other bands or just gathered things that are kind of unique that only they had access to. And when they passed away or moved away and their family members found it under the bed, they didn't know what they were looking at and just thought, well, no one's really going to want this. Even if we took it to Goodwill, they're probably going to put it in the trash, so I guess we'll just throw it out. Yeah. And that's the kind of thing I'm hoping to circumvent. I know a lot of people don't want to give up their flyer collections or whatever right now, but I've been talking to a lot of people just saying, you know, just keep in mind there is a way for you to sort of, whether you put it in your will or sign a donation form with us, that at time of death, and it's a very morbid conversation to have with people, which I kind of hate to do, but that they can go to a place that they will be loved and cherished forever.
Yeah, I started sort of doing a little bit of pre-work with that with my daughter, just letting her know that if anything happens to me, like, don't just sell these records to anybody. Let, you know, you got to talk to some of my friends and let them go through this stuff.
For sure.
So I've already given her names. Like, Matt's number one on the list.
I haven't even done that with my own personal stuff, and I probably should, like, think about, you know, where do these things go? Because, I mean, you can see behind me, I've got a music collection that has been growing over the past really like 25 years, that maybe longer than that, that I would hate for it to just go to the record store and somebody get paid like 30% of what it's like.
Yeah.
It'd be more meaningful for me to just have it go to a friend of mine or something.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Like I told my daughter, she's not going to get rich off these records. I've got some that are worth a little bit, but she's not going to get rich off of them, especially if she takes them to a record store. But I've got some friends that would love to have some of this stuff and can make sure that the stuff that they don't need ends up in the right hands.
Totally, yeah. I think that's right. I mean, I'm sure there's people who would love to have it to sell it, but those aren't the people that I would want to give it to anyway, so...
What age were you when you say you kind of discovered punk rock?
I mean, it must have been seventh grade, because that's when I really remember. It was seventh grade because that's when I started hanging out with kids who were into that sort of thing. Like, and I sort of started getting into skateboarding and punk rock at the same time. I never really had a place to skateboard, like other than like my basement.
Yeah.
So like growing up in the mountains of North Carolina, it's not like there's a lot of like asphalt, like when you like walk out your back door, it's mostly like leaves and trees. So I was never good at skateboarding, but I was interested in the culture, and I never went skiing or snowboarding like some of the other kids that I grew up with, just because my family couldn't afford it. But we bonded more over music, and that was something that I felt like I could sort of be part of and learn a lot about. From that point forward, I was just enamored with this idea of like learning about stuff that was not even the stuff that I could get at the mall or the stuff that was that those kids were listening to, but kind of this idea of like just finding the obscure, and it wasn't that obscure, but like stuff that I had to order through the mail or whatever that seemed like it was being written about in some of the magazines that I had started picking up and that sort of thing. So I think probably by, it seems like it was 9th or 10th grade, my buddy Dave Coker and I, who we later ended up playing in both of the bands that we mentioned, Heebie-Jeebies and Crimson Spectre together, he was sort of my best friend going through, he definitely was my best friend going through high school, and we started putting out zines together. And by putting out zines, that was another door that was unlocked, because you could trade people for their zines and essentially become pen pals that way. And there's never a way to like get free records, but I could get tons of free zines just by sending my crappy zine out to other people who did zines. And a lot of times those folks also wanted to make you a mixtape, or they might send you like a sampler CD or something that they got from a record label. So that was just a wave of new experiences and influences, and Dave became really close friends with some folks that he met through the zine in Johnson City, Tennessee. There was a guy named Tim Sheehan, actually, who put out a great zine called Better Days, and he was from Johnson City and ended up moving to California and playing in some bands with some folks who were loosely connected to the Bay Area scene.
Okay.
And we found out a lot about a lot of bands that were going on there through him, kind of even before, I mean, it was well before Green Day sort of broke and like people were like, kind of everybody knew about that scene. So I felt like somehow via Johnson City, Tennessee, I found out about the Berkeley scene. And that's just how it works, right? Like punk rock's all about word of mouth, kind of whisper network.
Yeah.
And it's like somehow you find out about bands in places that are super far away from you. And of course that was all pre-internet. So like people find out about things on forums and things like that now. But at that time it was sort of like you knew somebody who knew something about something. Like, I don't even know how I knew, like, all this gossip about people who were in bands that I liked that lived, like, five states away, you know? But somehow you kind of knew, like, oh, man, Tim from Avail cut his dreadlocks. And it's like, why did I care? And how would I even know that? But, like, somehow that was, like, hot gossip at the time when it happened, you know?
But like you said, you know, you know something about a certain place, but you might not know about what was going on in, you know, Charlotte or, like, right in your own state. But you know of all the stuff going on across the country.
For sure.
And a lot of it was through, like, Maximum Rock and Roll and zines, where you'd find out about these scenes and find out about this stuff.
Well, and you mentioned Charlotte. This is kind of embarrassing, but I also think it kind of demonstrates, like, just the hunger for finding out new things is not being able to drive. And I did know a couple friends who were old enough to drive when I was in, like, 9th and 10th grade. I'd never been to a punk rock show. I'd already been listening to punk for, like, 3 or 4 years by that point. But, like, no bands ever came to Avery County, North Carolina. And my parents were also super overprotective, and they weren't about to let me hop in a car with someone who was a couple years older than me and drive to Charlotte or Winston-Salem. But
yeah,
I was aware that bands that I was interested in were coming to North Carolina through, just like you said, like Maximum Rock and Roll and just other zines and magazines that where they would print their tour schedules. And I became aware of the Milestone, and also so the 1313 Club, was that in Winston-Salem or was that in Charlotte? I can't remember.
That was in Charlotte.
So I remember calling them, and they would have, like, pre-recorded dates. So you could listen to, like, basically who was playing, like, for the next 2 or 3 weeks or whatever. And even though I had no chance of going, I would just call and listen to those recordings and, like, write down the band names and then try to go figure out who they were, especially if they were – it was like, oh, I know of that one band, so those other two bands that's playing with them that night must be good. Yeah. So, like, I found out about a lot of music that way. It was, like, kind of what you would do if you went to the show. Like, oh, I hope the openers are good or whatever. But, like, since I couldn't go, I would just always call the 1313 Club's hotline and just listen to the announcements and then figure out later if the bands were actually something I was interested in or not.
I'm sure there's still, like, a club. I mean, there's still some clubs in the country that do that, but I doubt there's very many that do it at all.
No.
That was the thing back in the day.
Yeah, funny thing is so obviously I've been to the Milestone a million times now, and that place is legendary, but I never even went to the 1313 Club, but I called it all the time when I was a teenager.
I think I even remember calling, like, Milestone one time, and then Penny answered the phone, and I'm like, I didn't know what to do, so I hung up. I wanted to hear the recording. I could have just asked Penny, who's playing this weekend?
For sure.
So when did you pick up an instrument for the first time, or what made you want to pick up an instrument?
Maybe? Yeah, I mean, I think it was... That probably came about around the time that Dave and I met Matt Welburn in Boone, and we were publishing our zine. I was kind of old enough to drive by that time, so I guess I was in 11th grade or so, and had started going to see some of the local bands when I could, you know, was aware of Pink Collar Jobs and was aware of Matt's band, and I think it was just sort of that influence of, like, probably Matt telling us, like, it doesn't matter how good you are, like, just get an instrument and play, you know? Like, if you guys want to have a band, like, you can come open up the next Raw Clown show or whatever, you know? And it's like, okay, fuck it, let's just do it, you know? And I probably had, like, I had this really shitty Squire guitar that, like, was my first guitar that I probably got, like, a year before that just because I was trying to figure out if I could even play guitar, but I never had a lesson, so probably just played, like, Ramon songs on it all the time. And then we started a band, and we were able to play a couple shows over in Boone with those bands, with Matt's bands and with Pink Collar Jobs, and it was amazing, and we just kept going, and then we moved away to college and kind of kept it going for a little while after that.
So that was, this was the heebie-jeebies.
This was the heebie-jeebies, yeah.
Thought I was a head facial hair. Teaser dog just staring at me. Feeling pretty hair in my good.
man. I really like that. I've got a copy of that demo tape. I don't have an original copy, but I've got a copy of a copy.
I might have an extra original I could send you. I think I've discovered a couple of them when I was moving, so if that's the type of thing you're into.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I've got, like I said, I got a collection of all that stuff, so I'd love to have a copy of it.
Yeah, so, you know, and that was a really fun band, but it never really matured past us just having that original demo, but in some ways, mm-hmm. that was kind of the fun and the magic about it was that it was our first band. We didn't really know what we were doing. I think the first time we played, first two or three times we played, we might have played like the same three songs twice, you know, just to like have enough material to, because nobody knew our songs at that point. So it was like, okay, let's just play the set twice in a row. Nobody will know the difference. But Dave ended up living in Asheville, and I was in Greensboro, and our drummer was in Winston-Salem. And then for a little while, Landon from Pink Collar Jobs was playing drums with us because our drummer said he got too busy with college and really didn't want to do it anymore. And then it just kind of evaporated. And at that point, I kind of stopped playing music and started focusing on trying to make my zine better. And that's when I, with some folks in Greensboro, started putting out Slave, which was a zine that I published for about 7 years. And believe it or not, by the end, it was distributed by Tower Records, which was kind of crazy. Yeah. And that was also one of those things where it was like, there was like a lot of conversations whether or not we wanted to actually put it in Tower Records or not. But it felt like it was going to make it sustainable because I was kind of paying a lot of my personal money out of pocket to make it happen all the time. Mm-hmm. And those last couple issues kind of paid for themselves because Tower Records paid up front and gave me the money to print it, basically. And then I was able to print like 3,000 or 4,000 of them. And most of them would be gone as soon as they came from the printers. And then, of course, the internet happened. And a lot of the advertisers that I was getting to put ads had started shifting to putting their ads online.
Yeah.
And it started to look like a decision of, was I going to move this to an online publication or keep doing a print zine? And I decided just to stop doing it because I wasn't quite ready to, like, try to make a job out of it. And I also wasn't quite ready to, like, I really love the physical, tangible, sort of, like, paper zine. Mm-hmm. I was doing all the photography, all the graphic design, some of the writing, and all the editing myself. And I just couldn't imagine it being the same online. So at that point, I stopped doing it. And then, it's funny enough, around that time was kind of when Dave and I started doing Crimson Spectre. Mm-hmm. So it was always sort of like I always had at least one creative sort of DIY project going. There was definitely maybe a year or two where Slave and Crimson Spectre overlapped. But I think I felt okay letting go of the zine because I still had the band going at that point.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I guess doing a zine for 7 years, it takes a lot of work. Like you said, you were coming out of pocket for a lot of it for a while. I've tried to get Gabba Gabba Hung going. As a matter of fact, when this podcast started, I put out an issue with the zine. There was supposed to be another one, but then COVID kind of killed my desire to do it. And then it's just been so hard to kind of get the motivation back to doing it. I've been thinking about maybe just doing something online with it as well, because it would be cheaper for me, and maybe I could do it sporadically that way a little easier. But I kind of hate to not put out a paper zine too.
Yeah, and you know, zine is like, it's hard for people to maybe imagine what I'm talking about because you say zine and it could be anything from like 2 pages folded together to like 200, but Slave was like, in some ways, like we modeled it after Maximum Rock and Roll or Punk Planet, and like it was like standard sort of magazine size, and each issue was at least 100 pages, so like it was a lot of work. And I actually got to the point where I was trying to put it out quarterly and had sort of deadlines for myself just to keep it going. And I hated dating them because I tried to make each one thematic and almost thought about each one in the same way as like the way a band releases an album.
Yeah.
And sort of tried to not have it to where it was like fall 2001 issue, you know. I just wanted it to be like issue number 3, issue number 4, and let each one sort of be in some ways like a statement in and of itself, so that it wasn't thought of so much as like a periodical.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about a little bit more about Crimson Spectre as well. So you said you and Dave decided to put that band together. Did Dave move to Greensboro, or were you, was he still living in Nashville?
No, he actually ended up coming to Greensboro, and he played in a couple of bands along the way, but at some point, Dave ended up in Greensboro. Chris Fox, who was in the Raw Clowns with Matt Welburn, yep, ended up in Greensboro. And then we had a friend, Scott Trent, who was ended up being the guitarist for Crimson Spectre. And Stan Gibson, who, you know Stan. Stan's amazing drummer and kind of was in every band in North Carolina at some point, I think. So, like,
Stan Huskins played a show with his current band just a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
Motel Glory.
So, Stan's still going hard. So, we all came together and played a cover show as the Misfits. Mm-hmm. And Dave sort of updated some of the lyrics and put sort of Marxist and sort of progressive slant on them. So this was like a Halloween cover show, but we were sort of like taking it upon ourselves to sort of, really it was Dave's stroke of genius to sort of like put this new twist on it where these songs that everybody knows and can sing along to could kind of be given a new life and a new context. And people loved it so much they kept asking us to do it even when it wasn't Halloween.
Yeah.
And we're like, well, if we do that, we probably should write some of our own songs. So it just evolved from being essentially a Misfits cover band to being what people probably still called a Misfits cover band. But, you know, our sound actually drew a lot more from thrash and kind of like contemporary punk rock at the time. I don't think any of our songs, anybody would ever say that we sounded like the Misfits, but we still used that aesthetic in terms of our album covers and our t-shirts and our artwork, and we wore makeup on stage kind of on and off, but pretty much to the end. There were definitely times where certain members of the band were like, eh, I don't want to do that anymore, and then they would start doing it again like four shows later. So, like, I think that it was just, you know, it was fun. So, like, I think there was never like any real sort of doctrine within the band that you had to wear makeup or that you had to like adhere to any certain way of doing things. It was just always just a passion project for all of us. And that band ended up lasting for, I think about 7.5 years actually. And we had an album and then a split with, another Greensboro band, Uaria, that both came out on Magic Bullet Records. Couple songs I still kind of like listen to. I feel like Dave is an amazing lyricist. I definitely was the least talented musician in that band, so I feel like I contributed by organizing a lot of our shows and designing the graphics and doing that sort of thing. I was probably better suited to be a manager than a bass player. I did write, if you call it writing, some of the riffs that ended up being a lot of things that I just sort of noodled around with in my room ended up being in our songs. So I guess I was good at sort of sparking a kernel that other people could massage into something that actually became a song.
So when that band broke up, was there any reason, or is it just kind of like everybody had, it just kind of ran its course? I mean, because that's how most, a lot of bands are long-term kind of end. It's just everybody kind of goes on and does something different.
Yeah, I think it was just life situations. Everybody ended up, by that point, over the course of like 7.5 years, like, I definitely had a more professional job. Dave was getting more into his job as a firefighter and also involved with the union. everybody kind of like moved deeper into their career. A couple people got married. Stan had moved away to South Carolina, and we went through two different drummers after him. So for various reasons, I think it just sort of seemed like it wasn't the kind of thing that we were going to keep going. And sure enough, I mean, couple years after that, I ended up moving away from Greensboro as well. So there's been people that over time have asked us to reunite, and I think we've even joked about it occasionally, but I don't even know what that would look like. So I think it really did just sort of, in a very peaceful way, just kind of run its course. And thankfully, like, I don't think there was any major drama or anything that caused it to end, which, you know, a lot of bands can't say that. So for better or worse, we kept the thing going as long as it needed to go.
Yeah, like I said, it's usually the bands that are only together for a couple of years, two or three years, the ones that are they crash and burn.
Yeah.
And those bands that are a little bit long-term, it just people, after a while, you like life happens. And so everybody kind of loses the time that they had for that band sometimes.
For sure, for sure.
So those are the bands, the long-term, the bands that last 5 years or more, I always feel like just kind of more tend to fall apart rather than explode.
Yeah, and you know, I'll be honest, at that time I was getting very heavy into photography. And I sold all of my music equipment and got a camera that I wouldn't have been able to afford otherwise. And I still kind of kick myself for selling that bass because I really love that bass. But I haven't owned a bass since then, and that was 2008. So I'm a filmmaker now and get paid to do so in my job working for the University of Mississippi making documentary films. So it probably was the right decision. I don't think I would have ever been paid to play a bass as hard as I tried. I don't think anyone actually would have paid to hear that other than maybe in a basement somewhere.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it all worked out for the best.
You think you could ever pick one back up, like something could ever make you decide, oh, I think I'll put a band together for fun?
Oh, yeah, I've definitely thought about it. And I've thought about it here in Oxford probably more than anywhere else that I've lived in the past 10 or 12 years. And a lot of it's just because there's no punk bands in this town.
Okay.
And it kind of just feels like, sort of like I was saying earlier about that responsibility of being the guy who has the camera at the punk show. It's like, okay, well, I guess I'm the guy that has to document this. Like, now I sort of feel like I kind of know a couple people who might want to play in a punk band if I put one together. And I almost feel like we're here. Nobody else is doing it. This town is definitely a town. Like, it's a huge college town. It's an SEC college town. Like, there certainly are enough people here that we could, like, get 20 people to come see us play. You know, probably more than that, just out of like curiosity of like seeing some 45-year-old dudes like play some music that nobody likes in this town. Yeah. but I've definitely thought about it, and I feel like probably at some point I will. If anything, at this point, it's just a matter of time. Having the time, I mean, to take on another project, because work keeps me pretty busy, family keeps me pretty busy. And I just don't know where I would work it in.
Yeah, definitely. So let's talk a little bit more about what you've done since then, I guess. Where has life taken you? And then let's get to, I guess, you know, what you're doing today with the,
sure,
the school and the archive.
You know, it's funny, like I mentioned before, and I don't think I've ever put two and two together like this before, but around the time Crimson Spectre ended, I started studying Chinese as a hobby. Had nothing to do with my work, had nothing to do with my life, and I had the ability to take a free Mandarin class. I was working at Randolph Community College in Asheboro, North Carolina, teaching photography from like 2004, and I stayed there till 2012, but around end of 2007, 2008, I started studying Chinese as a hobby. Then by 2010, I got a scholarship from NC State to go over and study for a full semester. And in 2012, I quit my job at the community college and went back to graduate school and was able to get a scholarship for graduate school by continuing to learn Chinese, which led to me moving to China in 2014 when I graduated. And I lived just outside of Shanghai from 2014 until 2017, and I was working for Duke University, opened a new campus just outside of Shanghai, and I was like employee number 32 that they hired. Okay. I was organizing the student activities, basically, and they only had like 90 students on campus at that time. It was a very small campus. It's not like Duke and Durham. Like, it was a very small campus. It was only graduate programs. But I got to go live abroad, which was amazing. I got to use my Chinese and improve my Chinese. It was amazing. It was a great, great thing that I'll never forget, that I always wanted to do, really, from the time that I was living in Avery County, because I just wanted to experience the world and got to experience so much of the world in those years that I was living in China. But eventually, for various reasons, I decided to come back to the U.S. and found this job here at the University of Mississippi, where I'd never even been before in my life. I did all my interviews on Skype. I was offered the job, and I moved here sight unseen.
Oh, wow.
Which was quite, and by that time I was actually living in Shanghai proper. Mm-hmm. And to move from Shanghai to Oxford, Mississippi
was
quite a culture shock. But it was worth it, because I was able to actually have a job that was making documentaries, and I got to really sort of choose my project as long as they were about the American South, because I work for this, I work for the Center for the Study of Southern Culture, which is this great center on campus that has had a tradition really since its inception of trying to look at, research, and document the stories of the American South. And the Southern Documentary Project is an institute of that center that hires a couple filmmakers as full-time staff to make documentary films. And when I got here, my boss said, okay, start looking for a story. And I came across the band Negro Terror in Memphis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Both because I was just looking for stuff to do, and also because I was trying to find a film to make. And their name stood out to me, and I was like, okay, I've got to figure out what this band is all about. And
Elvis Presley was Negro Terror music. Buddy Holly was Negro Terror music. Richie Valens was Negro Terror music.
You know, it means a lot to see a band that looks like me. It means like, hey, it's not weird to be into this type of music just because I happen to be black.
I'm a traditional skinhead. The skinhead attitude, the attitude of real unity, the attitude and the inspiration of understanding where we come from as a people. That's my worldview.
Went to see them and then reached out to them and said, hey, I'd like to make, I thought it was going to be like a 5 or 10 minute just sort of profile piece on the band. And it ended up being a feature, the only feature length movie I've ever made. And it was completely paid for by the taxpayers of Mississippi, which think is amazing.
My family knows nothing about this. That I'm being 100% honest with you.
There is a certain amount of fear just stepping outside half the time, because you never know what you're going to run into, especially living in the South and living in the times we live in now.
There's other black punk bands out here, but let's face it, we're different. We're living in Memphis.
I got to follow those guys around for about 8 months and film as many of their shows as possible. And that was my job. I was like, this is crazy. Like, I can't believe I have a job that allows me to do this. You know, that was back in 2017, 2018. And then through the pandemic, I wasn't really able to go out and film things. For various reasons. Like, not only did I not want to put myself at risk, but it's really hard to go out and ask other people to let you truly be invasive into their lives and like follow them around and film them while while COVID-19 has been going on. So, I was just trying to sort of think about what I could do with my time and came up with the idea of starting the Southern Punk Archive, because that's something that's based in things that have already happened. So I didn't have to go out and film new things. I didn't have to interview new people. I just started collecting and putting together the archive from contacts that I had, materials that I already had. And as the world has started to open up, now I'm starting to conduct oral history interviews with people that haven't been interviewed, haven't been documented, to capture some of those stories that will go into the archive. And I'm teaching a class this semester in documentary fieldwork. And one of the projects that my students have to do this semester is to do at least one oral history for the archive.
Oh, cool.
So at least every year I'll have, if I continue to do this with this class, I'll have whatever oral histories I'm able to capture myself plus the 10 or 12 that my students get each semester.
Yeah. So now what all kinds of things are in the archive and how is it going to be presented? Give a little bit more information about that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, right now it's really heavily focused around the materials that I've had accessible to me. So there's a lot of North Carolina bands that are represented from the late 90s and early 2000s, because that's when I was most active, mostly through doing Slave, because I interviewed some folks. I was trying to put out records at that time. I gathered some videotapes and some demos and things like that that I was reviewing for Slave. So I kind of just had my own little archive going, plus show flyers and things like that that I had designed myself or collected myself from that era. Again, mostly I found all this stuff in my box that I have for Slave materials that I just happened to hang on to for all these years, luckily. So there's that material that I've personally put in from my own collection. And then there's been quite a number of people who have reached out to me that have donated things. Most notably, there was a woman who was involved in the Southern Mississippi Gulf Coast scene in the late 90s, who was heavily involved in kind of attending shows at this place called the Little House that was a trailer park that had shows. Basically, this kid, Leo Boyle, his family got a new trailer, and he asked his dad if he could use the old one to put on punk rock shows, and his dad was into it, and basically they converted their old double-wide trailer, like knocked out a couple walls and turned it into a show venue. That place became a real staple of the Gulf Coast for about six or 7 years. This woman, Corey, was going to make a film about it about 10 years ago, and that project, for various reasons, fell apart, but she had gathered like flyers, records, actual like printed photos, and I contacted her, and she lives in Brooklyn now, and she actually shipped it all to me. So there's a large amount of material that comes from that area, and now I'm starting to partner with some folks who are involved in the Memphis Punk Archive to share some of their resources. So North Carolina, Southern Mississippi, and Memphis are all kind of heavily represented in flyers, photos, some music, and videos. And I'm digitizing. I've got some VHS donations that aren't up yet, but I've got a Vimeo channel that has all of our video content. I've started a Bandcamp that doesn't have everything that's going to go in the archive, but when the bands agree to let me put it on Bandcamp, I put it on Bandcamp for free. I realized pretty quickly when I started with the Southern Punk Archive that even limiting it to the South and limiting it to what I can do as one person is kind of overwhelming. Like, there's just so much stuff out there that can be gathered, that should be gathered, that it's going to be really a lifelong project that I'll probably keep going for as long as I can. Hold on just a second. Yes?
Okay.
Not right now. Wait till I'm finished. Okay. Okay. Sorry about that.
That's fine. That's absolutely fine.
tiny invader. So, you know, I do hope that over time that it'll become more inclusive of other scenes and other states. But right now, I feel like if I can just focus on those three areas that I mentioned before, North Carolina, Mississippi, and Memphis, get as much as I can through the contacts that I have there, and then also continue to accept contributions from folks organically who are from other places. Yeah. Once I hit the end of my resources in those areas, I'll find new ones to focus on. And maybe over time there'll be other ways that I have other people helping out with it. But right now it's maybe 20% of the job that I have to do. I can't focus all of my time on it, but I do. Like right now I'm editing a film that has to be finished by 2 weeks from now. So I haven't even thought about the archive in almost a month. But when that's over, I'll have some downtime and I'll probably go and start to shake some trees again. And I've also been filming some bands who are contemporary. So I do want it to continue to live and breathe, not just live in the past. So there's a band from Birmingham, Alabama called Qualifier that I filmed a couple weeks ago. There's a band from Mississippi called Night Surf that played the same show that I filmed. And those bands are not bands that have people following them around filming them yet, you know? And it's just like we were talking about before. They might break up tomorrow. They might be as huge as the Ramones in 10 years. Who knows, right? Like, but because they're playing a couple miles away from where I live, or even a couple hours away from where I live, and I have the ability to go film them, I did, and at least that document exists. It is the interesting thing, though, is because I feel like I get to wear both of those hats. Like, I can be sort of an archivist that's going out and trying to find these relics of things that have happened, but I'm also a documentarian, so I can record new things as they're happening as well. So it's a good problem to have. Like, I wish there were two of me that could focus on one of those things or the other, but
trust me, I understand, because like with the podcast, you know, part of the reason I started it was because I didn't want the past to be forgotten about. But, you know, in the process, a lot of the people that have stories from the past are still playing music today. So we'll help document what's going on today. But then in the, as well, the new bands that are coming out these days, I want to cover them as well. So it's a lot. It is a lot. It's a lot to do. And
for sure.
You know, I'm just focusing on a much, much smaller area than you are. But any of the stuff that I end up digitizing, you know, you're definitely welcome to any of that stuff. And I'm kind of working on continually improving the stuff I do as well. Like, I've already put up a Krusty's video that I want to do a better audio copy of.
Well, but, thanks for offering that. And, you know, that's the kind of thing I try to tell people, is like, none of the stuff that I'm gathering or posting has to be proprietary either. Again, I'm not so worried about people's access to it right now. It's more about just having it sort of in the vault so that it can be accessible to people. There's two or three things that I've posted onto our Bandcamp that's already on Bandcamp, right? Like, it's not about planting a flag in the ground and saying we're the place that you can get all this stuff. My philosophy is it should be as accessible as possible, which means if it lives in three places on the internet, that's even better, right? One of those places will survive the test of time. plus, when we put it into our repository, it's kind of maintained by the university. So no matter what platform they have it on, there will be librarians whose sole job is to take not just the stuff that I've put in there, but the entire archives of the library and migrate it, so that they're not going to be distinguishing or putting value judgments on, oh, that's just a band that was played in North Carolina for 2 weeks that nobody ever, they don't care. To them, they're all valuable assets that they have to, they're tasked with the job of preserving it, you know? So that gives me a lot of leverage as well, talking to people who might be hesitant about giving these things to someone otherwise. There's a lot of those types of conversations where it takes some understanding of like what I'm asking, because I think people do feel hesitant in some ways of like, well, I don't know, like even though I haven't been in that band for 10 years, I'm not sure we want to have that out on the internet for free, you know? And
yeah.
And that I can also understand, because essentially like it is kind of putting it into the public domain, at least for listening. It doesn't have to be available to download. It doesn't have to be the kind of thing that has to go onto our Bandcamp page. It can just go onto the library's website. But even that said, at some point you're kind of agreeing to give somebody else the right to manage that material. Even if it's not full ownership, it does mean anyone who sort of comes to our library or comes to our website does have access to at least stream that material.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, I don't think punk rock was ever about capitalizing off of the songs that you recorded, but, you know, it is someone's artwork and it is someone's creation, and I think that that's a conversation that is a necessary one each time that someone who was in a band or published a zine or was a photographer who documented their local scene, because that's the other thing that I'm trying to pull into the archive is people who actually did what I do, which is go to shows with their cameras and to put that into the archive as well. And that also gets into sort of their intellectual property and their creation, just like a band. And even though it's photos of bands or photos of other people, those are their photos. And they might not necessarily want to just hand it over to a university library.
Yeah, everybody's a little bit different with that, because I'm of the mindset that the more people that hear it, the better. I don't care how you hear it. I don't care if you pay for it. I don't care where you got it. I just want you to hear it. I want you to hear it. I want you to see it. Videos, everything. But then there's other people that you know, for one reason or another, you know, they put that music out 20 years ago and they might not feel the same way anymore. Or there's just a lot of different reasons why they might not want it out there.
Right, right.
And I guess I can understand that as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously the larger the band was, the more hesitant they're going to be to do that type of thing, because they may still have opportunities to continue to press their records and people buy them and that type of thing. So, like, and I try to explain to people, like, I don't want to do anything that inhibits your ability to continue to sell your records or, you know, if you are making money off of your band, like, that's not the goal here. So there's a way that you could give these things to the archive and not have it accessible for 10 or 15 years if you want to. But I do want to sort of try to get that commitment from people now, because like I said before, there's just so much stuff. It's hard to remember to come back to people 5 years from now and ask them again. But, you know, back to a question you asked earlier, just sort of like the scope of the archive, I think I described some of the types of things that are in there, but one other thing that I think is controversial sometimes to people is how to define what is and isn't the South. I'm fairly liberal as far as that's concerned. Like, I feel like if you want to call Baltimore the South because the band that came from there ended up playing like the majority of like their shows in like Southern Virginia, then maybe they belong in the archive, right? So I err more on the side of just inclusion than trying to like draw a border around things. And ultimately, yeah, it's just about not looking at state lines or city boundaries and saying this is the South, this is not the South. It's about the greater story and the greater context. And you know just as well as I do that rural kids in rural southern towns end up driving 3, 4, 5 hours sometimes to go see the bands that they want to see because they're not coming to their town.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe their town, like the town I grew up in, doesn't even have shows. So you end up on the phone, like calling and listening to voice recordings in Charlotte just to find out what bands exist. And then when you're old enough to drive, maybe you end up driving a couple hours to Charlotte to see those bands sometimes. So if I'm living on the border of, you know, Northern Virginia and Maryland, I may end up driving to Richmond half the time for shows and driving to Baltimore half the time for shows. So those people, I think, may have a foot in what we might consider by like some standards, like the division between the North and the South. But I just try not to think about it that way. I feel like, obviously, I'm probably not going to put bands who released their demo who are from like Santa Rosa, California or whatever, but like if there's a reasonable way to sort of justify that, like there was an influence or some sort of network that existed, then I have no problem putting it in the archive. I mean, there's also certain people who have sent me messages on Instagram or email that have questioned whether or not Florida is in the South. And those are interesting conversations to have. And I definitely understand, like, Miami is very different from Kings Mountain, North Carolina, you know? Like, the culture of those two places could not be more different. But I would also argue that there are places in Mississippi that are Southern in a very different way than Mebane, North Carolina. You know what I mean? So, like, the South is not just one monoculture place, even though people like to describe it that way. There's lots of different variety of culture and influence even in this region, because it's a large portion of the United States.
Yeah.
So in Texas, you know, Texas is kind of like divisive as well. Texas is so big.
Oh yeah.
It's kind of like part of the South, but also part of the Southwest. So, so I don't even know. I'm like, how do I even deal with Texas? Like, I guess I just, everything from Texas is in kind of by default, but like Texas is huge. And there's a lot of Texas fans that end up playing in California more than they play in even like Eastern Texas.
Oh, yeah. And I kind of feel like with the podcast, you know, I'm focused on North and South Carolina, but kind of like to piggyback on something you said, I've considered there's some bands that played a lot of shows in North Carolina that but weren't from North Carolina. I've considered having them on. And then I thought, well, why don't I really limit it to North and South Carolina? I can focus on North and South Carolina, but I can have people from anywhere. So I'll probably kind of end up going in that direction. Like there's a few people I want to get on that really don't have any ties to North Carolina, but you know, I feel like it's punk rock. We don't have to have play by these fast strip
rules
for sure. Anyway.
I mean, and you know, what happens if you end up with a video of like, I don't know, Fugazi playing at like some warehouse in Greensboro, North Carolina, but like there's tons of footage of like people in the crowd who are all from North Carolina, right? Like, so,
exactly.
So that video in and of itself, maybe the performance isn't that different from any Fugazi video that you can pull up on YouTube, but those people are from the scene in North Carolina, right? So like,
it's still a document of that scene.
So I've run into some things like that too, like people wanting to give me stuff. And like, at first I was like, yeah, I don't really know if I want to put anything in that's like from bands who like aren't from the South at all. But then I was like, well, if the show was here, people are going to see themselves, and also it sort of, who opened that show? Probably a local band, right? So that is part of the story of the Southern punk history. It's part of that history. It's part of that story. So it probably should go in. So it's like, okay, great. So there's a whole nother Pandora's box I just opened up.
Well, that's like, I want to get Mike White on eventually, and I figure I can tie it to North Carolina pretty easily because he loves John Coltrane, and he's played here a ton of times, and he's got connections. He knows a lot of bands in North Carolina, so I can tie it to North Carolina if
so,
I have
so
to.
So you're gonna love this.
But I could still like just interview Mike White to interview
Mike
White.
You know, Mike White was born in Virginia. At least he, you know, kind of. Not exactly from North Carolina, but just the next state over. So there's that connection.
Yeah.
I met him in Shanghai.
Oh,
wow. He came over. So there's really like one super active band in Shanghai that had connections back to the U.S. Because there are a couple guys who are expats from the U.S. Their band is called Round Eye.
Yeah.
And they started helping to bring over some bigger punk bands the last couple years that I was over there. And one of the first folks that they brought over was Mike Watt. And to go play in China, you're supposed to like submit your lyrics and everything to like the government, and there's a culture of ministry that like will approve or disapprove. And I think
wow.
most of Mike's stuff did not go through that. So like these shows were like super word of mouth, which means they weren't super well attended. But he gave a talk at a bar one night. It was like a Q&A on stage, and a lot of people came to that because they could publicize it, and they announced the shows there. But anyway, I went to the first show, which was the one that kind of nobody knew about, and because there weren't that many people there, Mike Watt was just sort of like hanging out at the bar, and I went over and I was like, "Hey man, I want to buy you a drink or something. Like, I feel like I want to pay you back more than just coming to see your show." And just thanks for coming to China, and I've been a fan of your stuff for all this time. And we sat down and talked for like 2 hours. It was amazing. It was just like,
oh wow,
he was such a nice guy. And I took some photos that night that I ended up sending him, and we exchanged emails until he was coming back. I was back in the U.S. and he was coming back to this area about a year ago, and I was supposed to go up to Memphis early to hang out and maybe photograph that show, and it ended up not happening because I had another work obligation. But he would be a great one to have on the show, just because obviously he has all the stories to tell. But he's just a super nice guy too, from that one experience I had meeting him, and like super accessible.
Yeah, I've talked to him before. He's a nice guy, but I didn't get 2 hours with him. I got like, you know, 5
yeah,
minutes.
Yeah, well, I also think being like the one white dude in a Chinese bar didn't hurt too much, because it's like, there's somebody here that I can talk to. So that actually happened quite a bit when I was in China. Like, you would end up in a room with someone that you would never have a chance to talk to for 5 minutes if you were back in the States. But it's like, oh, you understand English. Okay, we're hanging out today. And it was like, cool.
I can see that would be an advantage.
Yeah,
sure.
You know, the disadvantage is there weren't a lot of shows, there weren't a lot of events that happened over there that I was super interested in, just because it's really hard to get over there. So when it did happen, it was always amazing like that, but that was like twice a year, you know?
Yeah. Well, is there anything else that you want to talk about that we haven't covered yet about the archive or anything else in particular?
Honestly, not so much. I just feel like I really enjoy the opportunity to come and share some ideas about the archive and let people know that it exists, and encourage people to go to the southernpunkarchive.org and check out the materials that we have there now. Go to the Bandcamp and download as much of that stuff as you want for free. But also, if you have any materials that you've collected over the years, whether it's your own band's three-song demo tape that people haven't heard in 15 years, or it's show flyers, I'm completely open to digital submissions that can go onto the library website. I'm also completely open to accepting physical items that can go into the library repository that people can come and visit in person. It's not a museum.
Yeah.
So it doesn't require that things are given to us physically. If it is a digital copy, I do want the highest resolution copy available. So I don't really take a lot of stuff that people have just scrubbed themselves off of, like Google and my old MySpace pages and things like that, because I'd try to keep at least that level of, like, if I could reprint it on paper and it would look good, then I'll take it.
Yeah. And they can go to it. You said it's the Southern Punk Archive.
It's southernpunkarchive.org. And
just Southern Punk Archive. It's also, I wanted to clarify that.
What's that? I'm also on Instagram and Facebook as Southern Punk Archive. Okay. So people can find me that way as well if they want to inquire about making a contribution or just had questions about the things. I've got a couple of PhD students that have reached out recently who are doing their dissertations on punk that were just wanting to know if I had come across any bands in certain regions from certain times. And both times I was able, just from the stuff that I've gathered, to at least tell them, hey, I don't have a lot of stuff for this, but I at least know these things exist. And they were really thankful because then they could go out and do some of the research on their own. So I really want to be a resource as well in that way for anyone that might just be looking for something.
Heck yeah, I think it's awesome what you're doing. And I think it's awesome that you've got the forum to do it with, you know, with the school as the backing for that. That's I'm glad somebody's taking advantage of that opportunity. I guess what I'm trying to say.
I think you phrased it the right way. I mean, I think it's like, I was just sort of angling for some way to sort of like make part of my job about punk rock. And this seemed like a convenient way to do it that also hopefully provides a service. So it is selfish in a certain degree because I love this stuff and it gives me an excuse to listen to punk and look at photos and videos of punk shows while I'm on the clock. But it's also something that I'm trying to pay forward to other people.
And that's what it's all about, really. I mean, that's the punk rock way. Let's you know, keep this going for the next generation or for the next.
For sure, I just don't want to pat myself on the back too much because I do know that it's self serving to a certain degree that I just love to sit at work and listen to punk demos.
Trust me, I'm the same way. Like with this podcast, you know, I don't want to pat myself on the back too much, but man, I'm my biggest fan. I just want to sit around and listen to this stuff. And now I'm not my biggest fan. I'm the biggest fan of the music and the people. And, you know, what I put together is just, you know, it's a product of all of that. So, you know, I enjoy what I do.
Absolutely.
And I'm just glad other people do.
Well, I appreciate you doing so much work. And you know, I probably alluded to this earlier, but, like, it's folks like you who are working on more localized scenes that have the greatest ability to contribute to the Southern Punk Archive. Because doing this... Mm-hmm. Individually, sort of thinking about a region as large as the South, there's a guy who runs Panhandle Punk, which is in mostly based around Tallahassee, Florida. He's just a guy that's been gathering stuff from that area of Florida for really like two decades, and he has stuff that dates back to the early 80s, like as early as like George Tabb's first band, and he scanned every flyer that he has and sent me essentially what looked like, you know, like a textbook full of first-generation copy flyers. Plus, he's put out a couple compilation records of stuff from that era and submitted all that to the archive. So that would have been like 2 years of work for me to even find and gather that stuff, and he just gave it to us. So every scene kind of has their own local archivist, and I really look forward to partnering with those folks because they can take the work that they've done, share it on their platforms, but also share it on our platform. And just like you said, it makes it ultimately accessible in two or three different ways to people who might be looking for it.
Yeah, and I know a few more of those people, so I'll be sure and let them know about this. There's a couple of people that might hear about it through the podcast, but a couple of people I'll have to just let know. That, hey, this thing exists and you need to check it out. But there's a couple of guys I know that have all kinds of stuff and they're constantly posting it online. I'm like, man, I wish I'd have kept I've kept a lot of stuff, but like, I didn't keep a lot of stuff that wasn't really my bands so much. And I really wish I had more flyers and stuff from other bands. And I did keep a lot of cassettes, but I lost some of those along the way. There's just like a lot of things I'm missing.
Yeah, no. And you know, some people, I think, want credit for their work in terms of gathering that stuff. And if it is a substantial collection and it will have a substantial footprint within the Southern Punk Archive, there is a way for me to distinguish within the library's digital archive that this stuff all was donated by this person. Or it can have a name if that person wants to attribute a name to it. Like, this is the Eastern North Carolina collection, or this is the Mike Phillips collection, you know. So depending on what it is, I can't do that with every single donation we have. I mean, if it's someone just giving me 10 flyers, like, it that would get pretty messy. But if it is a substantial collection, that is something that we do, both to help acknowledge the fact that someone put a lot of work into gathering this, but also just to attribute the fact that this person, you know, went out of their way to make sure that it could exist in our archive. So, awesome. Yeah, thanks for the time, Mike. I really appreciate having the opportunity to share and talk about this. I'm sure I kind of talked in circles and about things that weren't that interesting, but I do appreciate the opportunity.
You actually kept it going really well, and this is going to end up being one of my shorter episodes, but that's kind of good because I'm due for a shorter episode. But it's going to be a really good episode, and the fact that I'll keep it shorter will make sure more people.
Yeah, I agree, and I think something that sprawls on for 3 hours isn't that much fun for anyone to listen to.
It just depends on who it is. And sometimes I have a couple of like 2.5 hour episode, and I'm like, man, I really should cut 30 minutes out of this. And I go back and listen to it. I'm like, I can't. There's just nothing I can cut out. But yeah, that's only certain people. And I try.
Well, feel free to cut me wherever you want. I grant you permission to cut half of it if you need to. So
this has been a Gabba Gabba Hunt Media production.
I'm just starting to launch our library page. A lot of it's been living on Bandcamp and Vimeo, just because the librarians haven't been ready to start publishing this stuff for me on their side. But I think I'll actually have that going within the next 2 weeks. So So it's a good time to sort of get on the train while it's rolling that direction. So.
Oh yeah, cool.
Yeah, man. Thanks a lot. I hope to hang out next time I'm in North Carolina. I'll let you know.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we'll have to do that. Maybe we can all get together in Durham, or maybe wherever we get together. Maybe Matt can.
Yeah,
I pass.
Are you living in Charlotte or near Charlotte? Or?
I'm in Kings Mountain. That's just where I'm still at.
That's funny. Yeah. I said Kings Mountain earlier. So. I didn't realize that's actually where you lived. So.